I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. 1 week before a closely watched and contentious presidential election, who would have thought that we would be talking about infrastructure, rising seas, extreme weather, FEMA, and a budding bromance between New Jersey Governor Chris Christie and President Obama? Hurricane Sandy has devastated wide swaths of the eastern seaboard. Yesterday, after touring some of the hard-hit communities in New Jersey, Governor Christie had nothing but praise for the president and the response of the federal government.
He has worked incredibly closely with me since before the storm hit. I think this is our sixth conversation since the weekend, and it's been a great working relationship to make sure that we're doing the jobs that people elected us to do. And I cannot thank the president enough for his personal concern and compassion for our state and for the people of our state. And I heard it on the phone conversations with him, and I was able to witness it today personally.
President Obama thanked a number of people, and at the top of his list was Governor Christie.
At the top of my list, I have to say that Governor Christie, throughout this process, has been responsive. He's been aggressive in making sure that the state got out in front of this incredible storm, and I think the people of New Jersey recognize that he has put his heart and soul into making sure that the people of New Jersey bounce back even stronger than before. So I just want to thank him for his extraordinary leadership and partnership.
Well, today on Radio Times, what impact could Sandy have on next week's election? And later, how disasters affect voter behavior. We begin our conversation with David Lightman. He covers politics and is covering the 2012 election for McClatchy Newspapers. And David Lightman, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So is this a bromance of convenience for both Christie and Obama?
It depends on your point of view. I'm going to play the down-the-middle fair reporter here. I mean, look, it's two men doing their jobs. Or, as you say, it's a marriage of convenience, and we can talk about that for a while. It just,
sure.
You know, it's one of these things, you got to get inside their heads. And I've been trying for 40 years to get inside politicians' heads, and who knows?
Who knows? But you know what, it is interesting, certainly looking at the last 4 years of the president's relationship with Congress, especially the Republicans in Congress. Makes you wonder whether a president or this president can work better with a Republican governor than a Republican member of Congress.
Makes you wonder, or a moderate Republican governor. We used to see governors like Chris Christie all over the Northeast, New England, even into the Midwest. I mean, you know, what they used to call the Rockefeller Republican, the sort of socially liberal, fiscally conservative governor. And it's a dying breed. Mm-hmm. There just aren't many of them around anymore. Chris Christie is like that. Let's go back to your question a minute ago, though.
Sure.
You know, what's going on here? Both these men, I think, there's some political calculus here. I mean, when you're president of the United States and governor of a state, you're sort of not allowed to be politically naive, and you come to understand everything you do is seen through that prism. And clearly, Governor Christie, he needs help for his state, and he wants to help his state. I think that's the top priority. But he also has his eye on the future. He's up for re-election. He may be a presidential contender in 2016, and frankly, it doesn't hurt him to look inclusive.
And he's also, as much as he's been a supporter of Governor Romney, he did criticize Romney for not releasing more tax returns.
Yeah.
Even his speech at the convention was a little bit more, was more about Chris Christie than it was about Governor Romney.
Yeah, and again, you wonder if he's got, again, an eye on that second term when he could face, as you know, all kinds of challenges from a strong Democratic Party in that state. There's talk that maybe he has his eye on 2016, as we just said. I think it'd be pretty hard in that party to get nominated with the down-the-middle approach that he has. I think he's, again, representing his state and, again, reflecting the politics of his state.
Well, it seems to me, and this is, you know, there's no insight in this particular question, but how an elected official, whether it's a governor or a president, deals with a natural disaster can make or break their career.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we could do, and you probably have done, a whole show on that. I mean, people still tell the story of Michael Blandick, the mayor of Chicago in 1979, and they got clobbered with a 19-inch blizzard right around New Year's Day, and he just couldn't do it. He couldn't clear the streets in time. The transit system broke down. It was a mess. And a month later, as luck would have it, there was a Democratic primary, and Jane Byrne, who very few people had ever heard of 6 weeks earlier, upset Blandick, and Blandick was the machine guy. Now, Byrne only lasted one term herself, but still, that's the cautionary tale all politicians remember. To a lesser degree, they remember Katrina, but that's a little more nuanced.
I was going to actually raise Katrina. Why do you see that as more nuanced?
Well, a couple of reasons. First of all, you had a Democratic governor of Louisiana and a Democratic mayor of New Orleans, and I know that the conventional wisdom is that George W. Bush looked inept, and arguably he did. But look at the Gallup approval ratings for Bush during that period. They were low. I believe they sank from about the low 40s into the upper 30s. But they weren't. It's not as though Katrina hit and a month later he was politically doomed. First of all, there were a lot of other things going on that hurt him. The Harriet Myers mess, remember that, with the
sure.
Supreme Court. And the Iraq War was not going well. So all those contributed to that fact. So Katrina certainly didn't help Bush, but it was part of a broader narrative, and there were Democratic political figures involved who I think a lot of Republicans tried to point a finger at as well.
But I wonder, looking at this particular race, and of course 1 week before the election, whether the president has a kind of advantage because he gets to be the commander-in-chief. He goes to these areas that have been hit hard by a storm. There are those photo ops of him with Christie and also, you know, hugging people who are in shelters.
Oh, no question, no question. President always benefits, or any leader benefits, immediately after a disaster. George Bush with 9/11. Even if we can go back to 1980, Jimmy Carter with the Iran helicopter raid, and I believe it was April of 1980. Now, today we talk about that as a fiasco because 8 Americans died. But at the time, as I recall, Carter's popularity went up because he had done something. He had shown leadership. It was only later that it sank. And at the moment, yes, the president's riding high. He's looking like a leader. He suspended campaigning for 3 days. He went out and appeared with a Republican governor. If in 2 weeks New Jersey and New York are still a mess, well, things could turn around. Of course, in 2 weeks the election will be over.
Exactly.
So when we all write our stories a week from today about why Obama won or lost, why Romney won or lost, certainly Sandy is going to get a paragraph or two. How high that paragraph is, let's talk next week.
We'll find out. Well, let me play a clip, and this actually goes back to a GOP debate of last year, and this is when a CNN moderator, John King, was asking Mitt Romney about disaster relief after a tornado actually struck Joplin, Missouri, mm-hmm. and he started his question saying that FEMA was about to run out of money and that there are some people who say they should handle the disasters on a case-by-case basis,
right.
And the question is whether states should take on more of this role. Here's how Mitt Romney responded.
Every time you have an occasion to take something from the federal government and send it back to the states, that's the right direction. And if you can go even further and send it back to the private sector, that's even better.
David, do you think those words are haunting Mitt Romney?
I'm not sure. Yeah, we've reviewed that clip over and over. I can even June 13th, 2011 at St. Anselm College.
You can probably recite it word for word.
Yep. And believe me, we pored over this. I don't think so. I mean, there's a couple things to remember here. New Jersey, New York, Connecticut, Delaware, the states that are affected are not swing states. I think most of them are Obama states. Now, this happened in Ohio, Wisconsin, Michigan. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think there'd be TV commercials. I think there'd be stump speeches, and it would be a huge problem. Romney didn't say, gee, let's eliminate FEMA. I mean, he offered what's been the last 2-3 years a consistent philosophy of his. So it's a little nuance there, but no, it's not haunting him. But again, had this been the Mississippi River overflowing its banks in Iowa, yeah, I think it'd be a different story.
But are you saying the people in Ohio or Iowa, they don't care what happens in New Jersey or how the government responds to...
Oh, of course they do. Of course they do. But it's not quite with the urgency. FEMA's not the urgent issue right now. I mean, there's other things. The auto industry, the economy, agriculture sector, and so on and so forth. I just don't think this is number one on the radar in some of these states.
But I also wonder whether this storm and the government's response to that storm does highlight differences between these two candidates about the role and responsibility of government.
It's a good point. Yeah, I think it might be taken that way, sure. The president quickly mobilized the federal government and all its resources. He didn't say, okay, Governor Christie, you figure it out. So, yeah, there's that. But, again, is that too nuanced for voters to change voters' minds at this point? I don't know.
Does a campaign ever really stop? The president took a couple of days off to deal with this crisis along the eastern seaboard, but I'm sure his surrogate, certainly vice president, was out there. Do campaigns ever stop?
No, of course not. Oh, my gosh. Especially in this 24/7 internet age. In fact, even as the president suspended campaigning, there were still ads, there were still tweets and so forth. They did suspend email fundraising and things like that, but... Yeah, a week before the election, no, never ends.
So even this is just part of that campaign message?
You know, we wrote a story about that, and inadvertently, or maybe advertently, I don't know, yeah, I mean, of course. The fact that the president is spending 3 days managing the storm, of course it becomes part of the campaign narrative. It has to, and he knows that. I mean, that is now the campaign.
Do you think, and there are large parts of New Jersey, parts of Pennsylvania, other affected states that don't have power yet, some people are told it might not be up for the next week or even more. Do you think that will affect how people vote, not how people vote, but whether people will be able to get to the polls to vote?
I think that's a great point. Yes, I do. After all, when you're facing life and death situations, survival situations, especially in states where you've been told over and over and over, Obama's won, it's over, you know, don't bother. Yeah, I think it could. It'd be interesting to see, though, how much the political parties and the campaigns work to get voters to the polls. My suspicion is, given both sides' organizational prowess, they're going to have buses, they're going to have rides, they will figure out ways, if people want to get to the polls, to get them to the polls.
The kind of old-fashioned ground game that people talk about?
Oh, yeah, it's out there, big time.
And do you think there could, of course, this is looking into a crystal ball and not knowing the answer to this question, but there are people wondering whether there could be a difference between the popular vote and an electoral college vote count.
Yeah, you could make that argument. I mean, Romney has inched ahead of Obama in a lot of national polls, and then you look at the state-by-state map, and you can make the case the other way. Happened in 2000. Happened several other times in history. Sure, I mean, there's so many different scenarios. I feel sorry for any graphic artist for a newspaper or website who has to try to put it all on a grid. It's a mess.
Well, how are you doing, David Lightman? We have to say goodbye to you, but how are you surviving the campaign trail?
Oh, wonderful. No, this is great. Our problem as reporters comes when it's over and all that daily rush.
You mean the day after?
Exactly.
You're already anticipating that?
I've been through enough of these that, yeah, the worst part is not so much the day after, but the few days after when all of a sudden everything shuts down.
Well, David Lightman, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Pleasure. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. He covers politics, the 2012 election for McClatchy Newspapers. And we have another guest waiting in the wings. We'll be talking about how voters think and act when faced with a disaster. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Philadelphia Business Journal supports WHYY and is hosting the 3rd Annual Small Business Expo Delivering Happiness, December 11th at the PA Convention Center featuring Jen Lim of Zappos, pbjexpo.com or 215-238-5126.
The Philadelphia Museum of Art proudly supports WHYY and presents Art After Five, a blend of jazz and international entertainment every Friday. This Friday, it's Japan Night, featuring Japanese folk music and dance from Iwate Prefecture, the area devastated by the 2011 Tohoku earthquake and tsunami. The group Koromori Kagura will perform dances from its vast repertoire, which includes furious jumps and turns, accompanied by percussion and Japanese flute. Beginning at 5:45, more details at philamuseum.org.
Native American or Indian? And when can you call yourself Native American or Indian?
We are so often imagined, but so infrequently well understood.
The author of Everything You Wanted to Know About Indians But Were Afraid to Ask, next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
Supporting WHYY, Tate Weller, Certified Public Accountant, celebrates 90 years of specialized audit, tax, and advisory services to national and global nonprofit and financial services clients. TAITWeller.com. Tate Weller. Focus. Expertise. Results.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane. Natural disasters are a test for all elected officials, especially for a president or someone who wants to be president. President Obama toured the devastated New Jersey coast yesterday with Governor Chris Christie. He's now back on the campaign trail. Governor Romney took a short respite from his campaigning. He also is back on the campaign trail. What do you want your elected official to do when there is a natural disaster or an emergency or crisis of some import? And do you think you'll be able to vote this time around? Give us a call, 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Joining us now is Neil Malhotra. He's Associate Professor of Political Economy at Stanford Graduate School of Business. He's actually on sabbatical this semester at the Russell Sage Foundation, and he's working on a review of how disasters affect elections and voter behavior. And Neil Malhotra, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me. Appreciate it.
We're happy to have you here. And would it be fair to say that presidents, elected officials get punished and or rewarded for natural disasters?
So the review of the current evidence, including kind of work by myself and Professor Larry Bartels at Vanderbilt and some others, has shown that, disasters by themselves can hurt the fortunes of incumbent politicians, especially presidents. But that the presidents can actually get benefits out of the disaster if they deliver relief spending and efforts after the disaster takes place. So we collected data going back to 1988, the Stafford Act's passage, and we found that if the president delivered relief spending to the counties after the disaster took place, it could boost their vote share by about half a percentage point of the vote if they doubled the expenditures from the previous year.
And it's interesting you say that because, and I think that this president and other presidents have learned their lesson. President Obama was saying yesterday that if FEMA and these other emergency government agencies receive a phone call, they must return that phone call in 15 minutes.
That's exactly right. And so even though we're only a week before Election Day and people won't have a chance to get the checks and the money to start rebuilding, the image that the president has portrayed over the last few days is definitely one of responsiveness, and they can expect that solutions will be soon at hand. So if anything, it seems like this disaster and the way that Obama has handled it is sort of good news for his campaign.
But even looking back at previous disasters, there have been some of them where a president has been blamed for a natural disaster?
So I think, it's always a little tricky to say whether they're blamed for the disaster itself or sort of the response. So, for example, there's a famous example from Professor Bartels' work of how Woodrow Wilson lost vote share in the New Jersey counties that had shark attacks the previous summer. Now, it may be that they're blaming Woodrow Wilson for the shark attacks, but it could also be that they're sort of blaming him for not delivering relief afterwards to sustain those economies on the Jersey Shore.
What then do voters or even just residents affected, what do they want their elected officials to do? And is it hugging them? Is it bringing in the National Guard? Is it something concrete? Is it something more psychological?
Yeah, I think there's maybe two things, one concrete and one more abstract. So the abstract is sort of knowing that the president is there on the ground doing the work that's necessary to get help. So if you contrast the image of President Obama with his shirt sleeves rolled up in FEMA headquarters versus President Bush flying, surveying the damage from thousands of feet up in the air, those sort of images definitely can portray more of an abstract image of responsiveness. But voters react a lot to concrete things, too. So we found that the actual money that's delivered from the federal government can help boost their vote share. Interestingly, though, we found that the money spent to prepare for disasters has no effect on whether presidents are reelected. And so we think that this creates sort of bad incentives where the government is incentivized to invest in relief and, send in the cavalry after the disaster takes place, but not prepare and build the infrastructure beforehand.
Which is a very interesting, I would say, disconnect.
For sure, especially since from the days of Benjamin Franklin and Poor Richard's Almanac, we've known that an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. And so we estimated that if you spent a dollar actually preparing for the disasters, that's worth $15 in relief spending. And that makes sense because a lot of relief spending is essentially checks given to communities and individuals, whereas prevention spending is used for the entire community to mitigate the effects of these disasters.
And is it? Do you think there's something sort of uniquely American about not wanting to prepare for a disaster, and then, of course, trying to figure out how to fix it once it's happened?
I don't think it's uniquely American, but it probably is something that just human beings is sort of a foible of human decision making. So I think people are short-sighted. The reason we have a social security system is because people have a hard time looking multiple decades in the future and making decisions today to prepare for it. So I think similarly, we see in a lot of domains, whether it's the debt of America or climate change, it's very hard for policymakers, especially when their election is coming up in a couple of years, to make decisions for society 10 years down the line.
But it is interesting, and whether this will last or not, what we're hearing today is, the reality of sea level rise, the vulnerability of these communities, the vulnerability of Manhattan itself or the whole city of New York itself to some of these potential future disasters.
That's right. I'm optimistic, but not overly optimistic. We also heard all this in Hurricane Katrina in 2005, yet New York City did no infrastructure preparation after Hurricane Katrina. Right after Hurricane Katrina, there was a referendum in California to try to invest more in infrastructure. So there was a big flurry right after the disaster, but 3 years later, that was old news and not much investment was taking place.
Interestingly, you said earlier that people want their government to respond and get, I guess, marked on how quickly they respond. But I was in New Orleans not so long ago, and whole parts of that city have look completely devastated. And that's,
yeah,
of course, 7 years after Katrina.
Yeah. I think the people there kind of know that. And, I think they are disappointed in the incumbent government's response.
Well, let me quickly reintroduce you. And I also want to give out that phone number again because we're interested in the kind of aftermath, the political aftermath, the economic aftermath of a hurricane such as Sandy and also other natural disasters. And of course, we're less than a week away from a presidential election and how these two events are colliding. Talking with Neil Malhotra, Associate Professor of Political Economy at Stanford Graduate School of Business. He's on sabbatical this year at the Russell Sage Foundation, and he's working on a review of how disasters affect elections and voter behavior. We want to know how this particular disaster or even past disasters have affected your behavior, even how you think about your government. Give us a call, 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Neil, going back to something that you said earlier about just the photo ops that come out of these disasters when an elected official is there, is that powerful for people to actually see a picture of, let's say, a governor and a president walking along a beach somewhere?
I think in the week before the election, I think it definitely is. Those images kind of get sustained in people's minds as they go into the voting booth. And I think Chris Christie's defense of President Obama is especially meaningful because if you kind of look at moderate Republican voters or people sort of in the middle or undecided, it's one thing for co-partisans to be defending the president. But if Chris Christie himself is promoting the president and sort of walking arm in arm with him, it sort of maybe convinces them that maybe they should abandon their party allegiances in this election. I would compare it to, for example, when a smoking company says that smoking causes lung cancer, people sort of believe it because their incentive is not to do that.
So you think actually Chris Christie could change people's minds about the president?
I think it could, especially since I think Americans, in a very abstract sense, desire bipartisanship and compromise in government. They see the federal government as a very broken system. I think the debt ceiling negotiations from about a year and a half or 2 years ago really damaged the perception that Washington works properly. So seeing any image of the president working with someone from the other party is good for him, especially since a recent poll came out showing that people actually trust Mitt Romney more to work with the other side, and that the president has not really kept his promise in some ways or the expectation he set in 2008 that sort of change was coming to Washington.
But it's interesting, and perhaps this is just politics. Not so long ago, Governor Christie was slamming the president at an event for Governor Romney.
Right, and I think in some ways that makes this statement and this kind of working together even more credible. Because if it was someone who had supported Obama for years, then it wouldn't be that surprising, a Democratic governor, let's say. But if a Republican governor is saying, well, he's done an excellent job responding, we're all Americans today, we're all New Jerseyans, it can be much more powerful, especially given that he said critical things not too many months ago.
I was talking with David Lightman about this, but I'd be curious about your observations, Neil, as well, which is it's interesting to see that perhaps there's more cooperation between governors and a president when it comes to some of these crises and natural disasters.
Sure, yeah. I think that's a really interesting point, and I think American federalism works in sometimes funny ways. Although in Hurricane Katrina, you saw the opposite phenomenon where you had Republicans at the federal level pointing fingers at Democrats at the state level, and it sort of spelled doom for both of those groups of candidates in the subsequent elections.
Do you think Katrina was a wake-up call to both parties?
I think it was, and especially I think for the Republican Party. In terms of, I think, what disasters do, is that Americans rarely have opportunities to truly see the competence of their elected officials. And disasters, even though the government doesn't cause them, are great tests and great clarifying moments. And, I think Hurricane Katrina basically made people question whether the administration on other unrelated issues, like the Iraq War, the War on Terrorism, was handling it properly. So I think people were willing to give the benefit of the doubt to President Bush on the Iraq War prior to Katrina because the administration was seen as very good in a crisis and managing. But then after Katrina, it's possible that people then started questioning the Iraq War a bit more because they said, well, if he messed this up, maybe he's actually messing up the war as well.
And in many ways, and again, I put this to David Lightman earlier, but in many ways, this election, if you sort of pare it down to its essential argument, is about the role and responsibility of government, President Obama having a very different view from Governor Romney.
I think that's true. Although, I think if you look at the polls of what the median voter wants, people want more government services and they want less government taxes.
You can't have both, though, can you?
Yeah, well, people want to have their cake and eat it, too. So it's kind of funny when you say, well, do people want more or less government? They want more stuff from government, but they want to pay less for it. I think this sort of broad philosophical debate between libertarianism and more of like a broader role of communitarianism is actually maybe not what ordinary Americans really how they feel. I think it's something that when we, people who are really interested in politics and political philosophy can debate. But I think a lot of this thinking of wanting your cake and eating it too is responsible for a lot of the problems in entitlement reform, climate change, and as we kind of looked at, infrastructure preparation for mitigating disasters in the future.
But can't you take an example like this and you see the public and even the government response and say to those people that want more government and less taxes, you can't have this thing because it doesn't work? Can't you use that as exhibit A?
No, I think it can be an effective kind of tool. Because at the end of the day, you have people, like, for example, people who rely on public transportation, et cetera, saying, well, the government is the only sort of body that can do that. Although I think, one interesting hypothesis is that, one reason possibly that people who live in urban areas versus rural areas are maybe more liberal is that they kind of see and visualize government more on a day-to-day basis. So they see the sanitation workers working. They see the police, the firemen, et cetera. And so one thing these disasters might clarify for people who don't have a day-to-day experience with sort of government's role in society is that they can actually see it in work. They can see the first responders coming out and saving people.
It is interesting. What we have been hearing over the last couple of days is, we're gonna put everything back to the way it was before the storm. Of course, that's going to take a lot of time and money. And I think the question is that the right thing to do? I don't think elected officials want to tell people with houses along the New Jersey shore, you can't build there.
Yeah, I think that's right. And, as we know, there's a lot of these kind of moral hazard problems when it comes to you know, where you build. And in California, for example, people continually build houses where there's fires in the hills, and the houses get burned down, and they keep getting rebuilt. And so, if you, you know, that point you were mentioning earlier about the role of government, it'd be interesting to say, well, maybe government needs to step in where people kind of don't know what's best for them. It kind of ties to Bloomberg's soda restriction, even too, right? Which is, we can't trust people maybe to make all these decisions individually for themselves. Yeah, it's kind of one reason we have something like Social Security, which is we know people won't save for their retirement, so we have to force them to.
But the argument, of course, on the other side is that people should be responsible for themselves, and if they make bad decisions, that's on them.
Yep, that's another way of looking at it. Although, you know, when push comes to shove, you know, when you have someone who's 80 years old or someone who's living in a coastal community and they need help, it's very hard to say no. And so, you know, the position of obviously the current administration is that everybody has to pay right now, because if we don't pay right now, people are going to engage in what economists call a moral hazard problem, that they'll purposely not take care of themselves, and then when they're in dire straits, then they'll ask for money, and then it's hard to not give them money. That's obviously a big logic behind Obamacare, right? You know, you have to force people, even when they're healthy, to give money. So then when they're sick, that their money is there to give them.
And the whole issue of moral hazard is you don't want to reward, what, bad behavior?
That's right. So, you know, it's just you don't want to sort of incentivize people to not be careful today when it's easy, and then when the piper gets paid many years in the future, then they're kind of have their hands open and you're in a hard position.
And do you think people are open to that idea, or it's we're struggling with this now?
Like a lot of things, I think a lot of economists say this is sort of a no-brainer that we should try to reduce moral hazard, but I think a lot of things that economists want are very broadly unpopular in the public, like, you know, getting rid of the mortgage interest deduction. But I think, you know, I think this issue in New York really kind of highlights a lot of the broader problems about not investing for the future, whether it be in infrastructure, dealing with climate change, dealing with entitlement programs, et cetera.
We're almost up on a break here, but since we're talking a bit about New York, how do you see then Mayor Bloomberg handling that crisis there?
So I'm in New York City right now, and I think I think he's done a pretty good job, but it's a tale of two cities. That I live above 40th Street, and nobody here has seen any problems.
Wow.
We kind of view everything as going great. You know, there's a little bit of hassles. You have to walk instead of taking the subway. It's hard to get a taxi. And I haven't ventured below, 14th Street, but I've heard they've had a much different experience, and maybe they have different opinions of how the mayor's been doing.
Well, let's take this short break. We'll get back to our conversation. Talking with Neil Malhotra, associate professor of political economy at Stanford Graduate School of Business, on semester at Russell Sage Foundation. And again, working on a review of how disasters affect elections and voter behavior. We're curious what your opinions are. Give us a call, 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Do you want more government and less taxes? Give us a call. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Wintertour presents the 49th Annual Delaware Antique Show November 9th through 11th at the Chase Center on the riverfront in Wilmington, Delaware, featuring 60 dealers specializing in American antiques and decorative arts. Highlights include a special lecture by honorary show chair, fashion and lifestyle tastemaker Carolyn Rome. Delaware Antique Show details and tickets are available at 800-448-3883 or wintertour.org. Wintertour proudly supports WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. We'll have the latest stories in Sandy's wake. Also, a new film from National Geographic tells the story of the Navy SEAL raid on Osama bin Laden's compound. Was it re-edited by producers to remind viewers of the president's role? That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture, here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
Independence Blue Cross is proud to support WHYY. Independence Blue Cross is dedicated to transforming healthcare to make a better coordinated system that is built around you. They're committed to leading the way to focus on preventing illness rather than reacting to it, pioneering new ways to pay healthcare professionals based on the quality of care, and using technology to update your medical information electronically so everyone can be informed. Further details online at IBX.com. Independence Blue Cross, changing the game.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Neil Malhotra, and we're talking about voter behavior, the impact of disasters on elections and voter behavior, and wondering what you want your government to do and your elected officials to do. Just one or two open lines at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Let's get Bill from Belmont Hills to join us. And Bill, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yeah, hi. Thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
I don't have a house at the shore, but we have many friends who have homes at the shore. And I think individuals should have the right to rebuild their houses at the beach if they want. I was raised in Florida. I think it's foolish. These are barrier islands, and they're dynamic, and they change. But if people want to do that and they can afford it, that's fine. However, I don't think the government should rebuild the beaches. And this is because, as we know, over the last few years, many shore homeowners have resisted public access to the beaches, even though it's the law. So, in effect, if we rebuild the beaches, we'd be subsidizing what are private beaches, or they treat like private beaches, even though under the law it says that all the beaches should have public access. So I think this is a great moment that if the individuals who own homes at the shore want to rebuild, and if they want their beaches replenished, we should leverage this moment and ensure by law, by statute, getting those communities to have more beach access and just have it open to all.
Well, Bill,
it's a great opportunity.
I hear you. Let me see what Neil Malhotra says. Neil, what do you think?
I think that's a very good point. And, I mean, one thing I'd kind of point out to that is that, you know, the government has to usually step in when it comes to people building on the shoreline. You know, no private insurance company will offer flood insurance for, I think, a lot of these reasons. It's kind of a requirement if you live in a flood zone. And even so, it's never really fully covered. I'm originally from California, and the kind of moral hazard problem I was talking about is that very few people hold earthquake insurance there, because they think that if the big one were to ever come, then the government would sort of pay for them anyway. It would be too big to fail in such a way. And so I think what we worry about is that, you know, I think all those procedures about beach access are fine, but we have to worry when we build new communities is that, are we going to set up too big to fail situations, not only for banks, but for ordinary homeowners as well.
Bill, thanks for the call. Let's see what Mary from Chestnut Hill has to say. Mary, go ahead. You're on the air.
Thank you, Mayor. This whole thing, it just points out to me, I'm 79 years old and I've been through the hurricane of 44 and 62 and all those down at the shore. I love the shore. My family's gone there for years. But people should not be able to build within, say, three blocks or whatever somebody determines is a safe distance and put a lot of dunes back in. And it's not up to the rest of the taxpayers to subsidize people wanting to live with oceanfront views.
Well, Mary, it sounds like you and Bill are comrades in arms on this issue. Thanks for the call, Mary. Neil, anything you want to add to that?
No, that's a great point. And just to kind of parallel it to the soda, Bloomberg soda example, is that, you know, people maybe should have the right to drink whatever soda they want, but eventually when those people are in the emergency room, we all have to pay for it. So this is exactly kind of a big question about externalities and the role of government, as you mentioned earlier.
Mary, thanks for the call to Radio Times. You can call as well, 1-888-477-9499. Neil, let me throw a couple of other things out, and just looking at how a story of a disaster, whether it's Sandy or Katrina or other disasters as well, how that gets amplified by the press, it gets picked up by social media. How does that kind of factor into how voters think about voting or how people think about what's actually happening?
Yeah, that's a great question. So, you know, a lot of my research has shown that a lot of what we see in elections, the postmortem, is not that people are analyzing closely the government's performance, but a lot of it is sort of an emotional reaction to how they think the status quo is. Mm-hmm. So, for example, some research I've done showed that voters reward and punish incumbents for the college football game outcomes before Election Day.
No.
Yeah.
No.
So this is in a science journal that we published a few years ago. It sort of, if you think about it, makes sense, because if voters are in a good or bad mood, then it can affect how they view the status quo and whether they want to reelect the incumbent. And so this sort of gives us a new view of what a voter might be doing in response to the economy or a natural disaster. And I think the media plays a very big role in framing a disaster and the economy for voters. and sort of amplifying whether it's in a good or bad mood. A good example is the 1992 election when George H.W. Bush lost. The numbers would say that the economy actually wasn't doing that bad and was actually on the upswing, but the media coverage was how bad the economy was, and people reacted more to sort of the emotional reaction to the media coverage than digging into the numbers that were reported in the Wall Street Journal.
So it's how people feel. There is always that question about how do you feel about a presidential candidate or the president, that really does matter?
Well, at least we would suggest that it does, because otherwise, you know, the college football games wouldn't have any outcome because they have nothing to do with government performance.
And who's playing on Monday night?
Right.
I don't know. What about the fact that, at least as it stands now, so much of the East Coast has been so hard hit by Sandy? There are concerns about whether people can get to the polls, whether they, you know, there'll be electricity so that people can actually vote. Have you looked at that?
It's a little hard to say right now because, you know, we just don't know how many days or weeks it's going to take to get things up and running. So it's a little hard to say, but I do think that the early voting that's been curtailed is not going to have a huge effect because people who vote earlier with convenience voting methods, these are habitual voters who they're not going to let things stop them from going to the polls. But the people that really get affected by weather are people that vote on election day. I think as your previous guest mentioned, this is mainly taking place in uncompetitive states. And what I worry is that, you know, if we have one of these unclear elections again where, for example, the president wins the electoral vote, as a lot of the state polls are suggesting, but then this compounds his tie in the popular vote and he loses the popular vote, it would be very easy, I think, to sort of brand him as an illegitimate president and making it very difficult to get legislation passed in the second term.
Is there precedent for postponing Election Day?
There is at the local and state levels. So New York City postponed the mayoral election in 2001 after September 11th. But at the federal level, where the Constitution kind of plays a role, I've never seen anything like that.
And people did vote during the American Civil War, did they not?
That's right. There's precedence for even in times of sort of huge crisis that, you know, Election Day is Election Day. But it'll be interesting to see sort of what goes on. And one thing they might do, for example, is make it easier to sort of cast provisional ballots or extend absentee balloting or move and consolidate polling locations or change polling hours. One thing to caution is that what political scientists have found is that all of these even seemingly minor changes, like moving a polling place, it disrupts people's routine, and people who kind of they want to vote but they're not that excited about it, their turnout can be depressed by all these changes pretty significantly.
And that's where that ground game that I was talking with David Lightman about, for all the candidates, that's where that ground game comes in?
Oh, for sure. If you think about it, that, you know, these undecided voters are very hard to find, and who knows if they really exist. But I'll tell you, there's a lot of voters who support a candidate, but they're just not that into politics. And convincing them to spend some time for an act which doesn't give a lot of individual reward but is important for the collective rewards is a very important thing to do.
And how do you see these undecided voters? We've done a number of shows and have had a variety of adjectives used to describe them. How do you see them, Neil?
Well, I'm collecting data on this right now with the Associated Press, so call me back in a month.
Oh, is that right?
But at least the hypothesis we're kind of looking at is that maybe some of these people are cross-pressured in that the parties don't actually represent their full system of beliefs very well. So, for example, if you're a libertarian, neither of these parties do a very good job tapping your beliefs. So one hypothesis we're kind of seeing with this Associated Press data that will be coming back is maybe it has something to do with the fact that the two-party system doesn't represent a lot of Americans in the current contemporary American system.
And in fact, people have fled those two parties, have they not?
It's always a little hard to say. So there is this sort of abstract desire to be an independent. And I think part of being an undecided voter is that you're seen as a very reasoned, unpartisan, unpolarized person. The tricky thing, though, is that a lot of these people are closet partisans. So they really do have an attachment to a candidate. But they like being thought of as undecided because it makes them seem independent and above the fray.
Better than other people.
That's right.
Let me get Nancy from Thornberry to join us. Nancy, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi.
Hi there.
Thank you for taking me.
Sure.
One of the issues that's been a complaint with Obama has been that he's been very polarizing. And actually, he's reached out many times, and Congress has been the polarizing bit because they refuse any reach out that he's made. And what I think that when something like this happens, regardless of what your party is, you have to reach out together. And maybe something like this will be unifying and make things less partisan.
Was that a question, Nancy?
It's more of a comment than a question.
Yeah, but I heard your voice go up at the very end.
I'd like to hear whether they think that.
Fair enough. I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Neil, what do you think?
I'm not optimistic about that. Polarization in Congress and between and the president and Congress has been a secular trend that's been increasing more and more every year since the 1980s. It's never decreased. The caller is right that there's some evidence that is really occurring more on the Republican side. And I would say that there's been a lot more cases in American history where I would think an event would bring us together, like I think September 11th. But that even events like that have not abated the increasing polarization in Congress and in the federal government. So I'm not that optimistic.
And what has been driving this increased polarization as you see it?
Oh, that's one of the biggest questions in America today. I'll tell you one thing, it's definitely not that gerrymandering has absolutely nothing to do with it.
Really? Because that's been an argument that I've, or an explanation I've heard for years.
Yeah, so some professors at Princeton did a very good analysis showing it has absolutely very little to do with it. And there are two main kind of points where, one, the Senate has polarized as much as the House, but you can't change state boundaries. And the second thing they did was that they basically said, okay, let's let a computer draw the lines in the most fairest fashion possible and then see how much polarization there would be. And it's about the same we have today.
Really?
And because, you know, if you think about what gerrymandering is supposed to do, is it's supposed to actually make you not win too much, right, if you want to maximize your party to get efficient districts drawn. And there's never been a big increase in polarization right after the census redistricting takes place. It's something that's kind of constantly increasing. So what's really going on, I think, is that like-minded people are living closer together. And that makes it almost impossible in a system where you have to draw lines to draw very moderate districts. The districts are going to be extreme no matter who's drawing them. And another kind of thing that might be driving polarization is you have a lot of threat now in the primaries. And you see this with, you know, if you were to tell me 10 years ago that Orrin Hatch and Richard Lugar would be considered too liberal, I would never have believed you. Mm-hmm. And that's what it looks like now.
But by like-minded, you meaning they're living in the same neighborhoods, maybe they're watching the same cable news shows, they're reading the same newspapers, what's left of them, on the same kind of media, so they've created kind of segregated political worlds?
Yeah, and so, you know, if you kind of like going to the opera and living in an urban environment, you're probably not going to live in a place which has a lot of strip malls and megachurches. But if you want to have more open space and like going to, you know, having more community, et cetera, different kinds of people for politically unrelated reasons are going to move closer to people, and that's going to produce political segregation, as you said.
But there's much talk about the economic divide in the country. Does that also drive the polarization?
There's some hypothesis about that. So, for example, you know, if you just plot the lines together, it looks like polarization has been increasing in lockstep with economic inequality. But, you know, a lot of stuff has been increasing in lockstep over time, so it's kind of hard to say.
Well, let me get to Ellen from Wynwood to join us on Radio Times. And Ellen, go ahead. You're on the air. Do we have Ellen?
Hello.
Yeah, go ahead, Ellen.
I'm so sorry. I had to take it off speakerphone. I'm responding to the, actually reacting to the statement and the question that many people want more benefits from government without necessarily paying more in taxes. Specifically, that you can't expect more benefits from government if you're not willing to pay more in taxes. My immediate reaction was that was an incredibly simplistic statement because it doesn't address where the tax dollars that we're currently paying go. And then I realized it was a provocative statement because it made me think about tax reform and about having closing the tax havens and the loopholes for the wealthy so that they pay their fair share.
Ellen, thanks for the call to Radio Times. And, you know, we've covered a lot of territory. Have you looked at taxes and who pays taxes and our tax complicated tax system?
Yeah, no, that's a very interesting point. And I think we have to, you know, the tax, it's very simple to say that's right, just increasing or decreasing taxes. There's a lot of complexities in the tax code, and we don't exactly know kind of what people's opinions are on them. Those are hard survey questions to ask. But I will say that if you look at California referendums, where you give people the legislative power, consistently in California, they vote to have mandatory spending increases for things like education, high-speed rail, which are commitments the government has to pay. Yet they also consistently never vote to increase taxes and often vote to decrease taxes like Prop 13 or make it harder to pass taxes via supermajority requirements in the legislature. So at least when you kind of look at when voters have actually had to make a decision in a state like California, they've always said, we want more stuff and less taxes.
And doesn't California have some humongous debt?
Yep, and a lot of people attribute it to this initiative process where you directly give the decision-making power to the preferences of the public, especially on fiscal issues.
Well, Neil Malhotra, you've given us a lot to think about. Thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
You're very welcome. Associate Professor of Political Economy at Stanford Graduate School of Business. He's on sabbatical at the Russell Sage Foundation and, again, working on some research and review of how disasters affect elections and voter behavior. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes and you can find out much more about this program. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Thank you so much for those phone calls. Do stay with us. Hour 2 coming up next.